no one, community members or park aircraft, have been able to fly yesterday or today.
The search for a plane missing from Port Allsworth is suspended. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a faster border crossing program opens an office in the Fairbanks Airport.
So this just helps expedite legitimate travelers to and from the United States.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
An Anchorage grand jury has indicted a 21-year-old man in a double homicide at Anchorage's Point Warns Off that took place in January of this year. The Anchorage District Attorney's Office announced four charges of murder in the first and second degree against Jamal Hall through a press release this afternoon. On January 28th, responding to a 911 call, police found the body of Selena Mulinax. Soon after, the body of Oni Aber Morissette was discovered further down the beach. According to the DA's office, witnesses place Hall at the scene where he allegedly shot the two victims. Hall is still at large. He is also wanted by police for a robbery at an Anchorage Walgreens last month. The National Park Service is suspending the search for a small plane believed to have crashed into Lake Clark last Wednesday with four people on board. The plane crashed shortly after taking off en route to Anchorage. Park Service officials said today the search has been hampered by ice fog over Lake Clark. Officials say items found in the lake last week confirmed the plane crashed there. Megan Renshot is a spokesperson for Lake Clark National Park.
We are dealing with persistent ice fog off of Lake Clark, and that is hampering the air search. The Alaska State Troopers arrived on Saturday. They were able to fly for less than an hour with their helicopter over the lake.
Troopers did not see any new debris. On Thursday, a boater found items belonging to occupants on the plane, and on Friday, the co-pilot seat and all three wheels were found on the lake, approximately 11 miles northeast of Port Allsworth. The aircraft left Port Allsworth at 10:30 Wednesday morning, but never arrived in Anchorage. Rayshot says searchers have been grounded since that trooper flight on Saturday.
No one, community members or park aircraft, have been able to fly yesterday or today.
The bay around Port Allsworth is frozen, so searching on the lake has been limited to small boats. Presumed killed in the crash are pilot 25-year-old Kyle Longerbeam, passenger 45-year-old Scott Bloom, and his two children, 13-year-old Zach and 14-year-old Caitlin. So far, more than $30,000 has been raised to help with travel and funeral services for the families. Interior Alaska residents have easier access to a federal program that expedites international travel. U.S. Customs and Border Patrol has opened a global entry enrollment office at Fairbanks International Airport. CBP Assistant Area Port Director Jerry McGee says the program smooths and speeds entry into the U.S.
You can drive across and you'll have an expedited lane to utilize for enrollees. If you travel internationally via airplane, you will have a specific kiosk for expedited processing as well. So this just helps expedite legitimate travelers to and from the United States.
The new Fairbanks application office is the second in the state. Anchorage also has a global entry program facility. McGee says the office provides a place to interview and submit enrollment applications.
It's a process where they fill out some basic information. They will set up an interview. They will go and meet with a Customs and Border Protection officer to finalize the enrollment, and then they will be ultimately mailed a card that will fit in their wallets.
McGee says enrollment in the Global Entry Program, which costs $100 and lasts for 5 years, also includes TSA PreCheck privileges for expedited movement through security at domestic airports. In a departure from big wish lists of the past, Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz's legislative request has only one capital budget project. Berkowitz submitted his legislative program to the city's assembly on Friday. It's a wish list to state lawmakers of things the municipality hopes to see in the upcoming session. The administration's request also contains a number of law changes designed to give local governments more financial flexibility. Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports.
The legislative program is just 7 pages, actually 6 if you don't count the title page. Ona Brous is the mayor's deputy chief of staff and says this year's program is an intentional step towards a new funding relationship between Anchorage and the state.
We had a pretty sparse request last year, and we're continuing at that. In the past, the legislative programs have been 50, 60 pages deep, and with the way the state is dealing with the fiscal situation, we don't expect them to have very large capital budgets.
The one big request is for almost $300 million for improvements to the Port of Anchorage, something city officials insist is a statewide asset in critical need of repair. But many of the items requested are changes to state law that'll allow local governments more latitude in collecting funds for themselves. For example, letting municipalities set property tax exemptions rather than state statutes determining them, or ironing out a section of SB 91, the criminal justice overhaul that lowered fines for traffic violations in the municipality, or getting rid of mandatory sprinkler system exemptions, because Anchorage's building code makes that redundant. Brous says the goal is adjusting or eliminating some of the state laws that hinder the municipality's ability to raise revenues.
So our request focuses on the largest infrastructure need for the municipality, coupled with legislation that frees up municipalities to make decisions at a local level that they have been prevented to by the state legislation in the past.
The other major change requested by the administration is the replacement of the current municipal revenue sharing program with a community dividend. Brous says the idea came from former Governor Wally Hickel and relies on an endowment model similar to the PFD to redistribute the state's wealth to local governments for more predictable budget building. Payouts to Anchorage from the current program have ranged from $20 million to just $4 million, and Brous says that's been a challenge in local budgeting.
Having a firm, predictable funding source from the state is something that all the municipalities and local governments need.
Brous admits the administration's legislative program has some pretty heavy lifts, but she says she's optimistic that politics in Juneau may be a bit different now with a new majority caucus in the House. In Anchorage, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tracking the origins of the black carbon that ends up on Juneau's glaciers.
Turns out we estimated that it's the second largest climate warming agent after carbon dioxide.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
The women's volleyball team from the University of Alaska Anchorage had its best ever finish over the weekend. The Sea Wolves claimed second place in the NCAA Division II National Tournament. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Top-ranked Concordia St. Paul beat the Sea Wolves in 3 sets, 25-19, 25-12, and 25-12 to claim the national title. But in spite of the loss, UAA head coach Chris Green says the tournament was a great experience for the squad.
Hopefully we learned something tonight, learned what it takes to be a national champion, you know.
The Seawolves were led by senior All-American setter Morgan Ho. Playing in the national championship game is the pinnacle of Ho's collegiate volleyball career, which ended with this tournament.
Coming in with seven new kids this year, I honestly never thought we'd get this far. But, you know, they surpassed everything I thought about them. So it's been a hell of a last season. And so even though we're second in the nation, I mean, we're second in the nation, and we're from Alaska. So that's pretty amazing in itself.
Ho was also named to the NCAA All-Tournament team. So too was her teammate, sophomore outside hitter Chrisalyn Johnson. Coach Green says the team has received an extraordinary amount of support from the community on the way to its national tournament bid.
And you can see it when you come to our home matches and you see 1,200, 1,400, 2,700 people in the stands. We have, you know, middle school girls that look up to these young players and they want to be the next Morgan Ho. So it means a lot. Alaska Volleyball, we hope we're helping those young girls in the state of Alaska want to be volleyball players. We want those best athletes to become volleyball players, and these guys are the role models that are making that happen.
UIA will only lose two players from this squad to graduation, Ho and middle blocker Aaron Braun. The other 12 members will be back with the Seawolves next year for another run at a national championship. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
For the first time ever, scientists this year started sampling the snow and ice above southeast Alaska's glaciers for the particles left over from forest fires, diesel engines, and industrial activity. The particles of black carbon can accelerate warming of glaciers and the atmosphere. The big question is, where does this carbon come from? For Alaska's Energy Desk, KTOO's Matt Miller has more on the story.
Sample right here.
Jason Fellman opens an upright freezer in a University of Alaska Southeast research facility located off campus in Juneau. The freezer is filled from top to bottom with plastic bags packed with about a liter of snow.
What is that one?
So this is from the Mendenhall, so this is like a middle elevation site on the Mendenhall.
Fellman is a research assistant professor at UAS who studies how carbon flows through watersheds. He participated in the first ever effort to sample black carbon from multiple locations on the Juneau ice field, high above the capital city.
Different locations on the Gilkey, Eagle, the Herbert, and Lemon.
First, in the early spring, Fellman and his colleagues took surface samples and dug snow pits down about a meter. That gave him an idea of how much black carbon had fallen with the winter and spring snowfall. They returned to the same sites in the summer to find out how much black carbon had accumulated without being deposited by snowfall. And looking closely in these bags of snow, you can't see the microscopic particles of black carbon, otherwise known as soot.
Visually, it's really hard to see them. They're pretty small, I think, for the most part.
The total amount of black carbon in the atmosphere is still the subject of ongoing research and debate, but you probably see it in its concentrated form every day.
If you look at, like, the particulates coming out of a really dirty burning diesel engine, so you see this black smoke come out, that's almost completely black carbon.
Sarah Doherty is a senior research scientist specializing in atmospheric sciences at the Joint Institute for the Study of the Atmosphere and Ocean in Seattle. Doherty says black carbon emissions are a public health issue. They're also a major factor in climate change.
Turns out we estimated that it's the second largest climate warming agent after carbon dioxide, and it's sort of on par with methane.
But Doherty says you can't just slow down the Earth's warming by removing black carbon from the atmosphere or all burning sources.
That component contributes a lot to climate warming, but you can't just remove that component without removing other components that also affect climate.
Any type of burning source produces organic carbon and sulfates that may scatter light and cool the climate. Doherty says black carbon particles do not break down in the atmosphere, but they're also chemically inert, meaning they do not react with other substances.
They also get incorporated in cloud droplets, so they get washed out of the atmosphere in rainfall or snowfall.
If any significant deposits of black carbon settle on snow and ice, Doherty says it could kick off more melting in a positive feedback loop.
Sort of change in the evolution of the snowpack itself, which again makes it less reflective, absorb more sunlight. And both of those contribute to the snow melting sooner. And once it starts melting, it gets even darker. So it sort of accelerates the snow aging process.
Sonia Nagorski is a UAS assistant professor of geology who helped with the sampling on the Juno ice field. She says despite their very small size, black carbon particles can retain additional solar energy as they settle on the snow and ice and accelerate melting of glaciers.
Yeah, we saw small leaves on the snow, just little translucent brown leaves, and most of them were already sort of sunk into the snow like a post hole, just showing how any kind of dark color absorbs more solar radiation, heat melts the bit of snow right around it. And so that's sort of on a big scale what's happening with black carbon particles.
The UAS sampling project aims to answer two big questions. How is the black carbon affecting the melting of the Juneau ice field's glaciers? And is it coming from nearby in town or maybe from across the Pacific Ocean? Once it's determined exactly how much black carbon is being deposited, then UAS Professor of Environmental Science Aaron Hood says they can figure out how much, if at all, it's affecting the ice field's albedo or how much solar energy is being reflected back into space. Hood says it'll also be useful to compare the black carbon found on the Juneau ice field to other relatively isolated locations.
Is most of what we're seeing just global background, or are there actually some local sources that might be contributing to what we're seeing up there? And then in turn, how much is that going to influence the melting of the ice field?
The black carbon will also be radiocarbon dated to give a rough idea of its age.
Is it anthropogenic, which would be a fossil fuel source, or is it biogenic, which would be burning wood, whether you put it in a wood stove or whether it's burned through a forest fire?
Hood says preliminary results of their black carbon analysis should be available early next year. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Matt Miller reporting in Juneau.
Former Juneau State Representative Beth Kurtula returned to Alaska this summer after 2 years serving the White House as director of the National Ocean Council. In this position, she helped two regions write the country's first marine plans and worked on some issues particularly important to Alaskans. APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman sat down with her to talk about the future of the oceans and Alaska.
Kurtula says it's important to plan for the future of the oceans that surround Alaska and the rest of the United States. She says just as people can have personal trauma when they plan for their futures, the U.S. oceans could face disaster.
If you aren't planning where your ship lanes are, if you aren't planning around the sea mammals, if you're not planning so that you can have development, then you're going to have a mess at some point, and you're going to have conflict between subsistence users, between the developers.
The attraction of making a difference for the future of the oceans is why Kurtula left the Alaska House of Representatives in 2014, after 15 years. The Juneau Democrat served as the minority leader for her last 7 years in the House. She spent 6 months at Stanford University's Center for Ocean Solutions before she joined the National Ocean Council. President Barack Obama formed the council under an executive order in 2010. Kurtula explains why he did it.
It's a huge challenge right now with the ocean. We're facing some very severe problems: ocean acidification, erosion, sea level rise, the lack of coordination among users, the lack of coordination among the federal agencies, and all of those things are really coming to a head.
The National Ocean Council includes 27 federal agencies. Kurtula worked with officials in all of the agencies to plan with state and tribal governments. The council adopted the first two marine plans on December 2nd, covering the waters off of the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. She says planning is especially important for Alaska.
We have so many conflicts, and we have worse problems on the horizon, particularly in our ocean space. And this is just a really wonderful method to be able to put all of the users, the stakeholders, the federal agencies, the tribes at the table.
Along with resolving conflicts, Kurtula says the focus on planning can provide more information about coastal waters, such as mapping the seabed.
We know so little about the ocean floor. We don't even have charts. I mean, in many parts of Alaska, we don't have accurate charting. So it comes down also to health and safety.
Kurtula was also engaged in efforts to stop illegally caught fish from being brought into the country.
One of the things that was very shocking to me when I went outside, spent so much time outside these last 2 years, was the problem with illegal fish. I mean, and not knowing what fish you were even getting many times in restaurants.
Curtula ended her work at the end of June. Since Obama launched the National Ocean Council with an executive order, President-elect Donald Trump will be able to end it with a stroke of a pen. That has Curtula worried.
My hope is that there won't be knee-jerk reactions about overturning the executive order. But there's a lot of concern about it and about what that would mean. If that happens, the effort's not going to stop because you need something like this.
She's taking some time off now that she's returned to Juneau, helping her husband, University of Alaska Southeast professor Jim Powell, and her elderly father, former state senator Jay Curtula. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
A bill on its way to the president's desk authorizes most of the money needed to build a new boat harbor in Craig. But the funding itself will have to wait for future congressional action. The legislation includes about $29 million for the harbor in Prince of Wales Island's largest city. Craig City Administrator Jim Bowling says that's the cost of planning and installing large breakwaters.
They're high-cost items. And they need to be in place first before any floats are constructed because the site is too exposed to add a float system in without the protection of the breakwaters.
About another $3 million in state and local funds are needed to install floats and related infrastructure. The authorization comes from the Water Infrastructure Improvements Act, which passed the U.S. Senate on Saturday. It already passed the U.S. House. It also authorizes federal spending for other Alaska projects, including harbor work at Elfin Cove, Valdez, Little Diomede, and St. George. Administrator Bowling says there's only a preliminary harbor design, but it will include room for commercial and private boats of various sizes.
It's a mix of long open runs of float and conventional slips, stalls for various boat sizes from smaller boat length of 20 feet up to 60 or foot long or greater.
Alaska's congressional delegation pushed to include the funding authorization in the water bill. Bowling says it's a very important step toward construction. Craig already has about 220 slips plus transient moorage in two existing harbors. The new harbor will be built at the old Craig cannery site. The Tongass Land Management Plan Amendment, a 16-year transition toward young-growth logging, was finalized on Friday. Tongass Forest Supervisor Earl Stewart signed the Record of Decision after considering objections from environmental and industry groups. Some have applauded the decision, and others are unsatisfied. But regardless of sides, not much has changed in the Forest Service's move away from old-growth timber. KSTK's Aaron Bolton reports.
The U.S. Forest Service released the final Record of Decision for the Tongass Amendment without many changes from its earlier draft. The final plan offers an average of 46 million board feet each year, the same volume the earlier draft called for, but far below the glory days of the timber industry. More old growth will be offered during the first 10 years, almost three times the projected 12 million feet of young growth. During the last five, young growth volumes will more than double, and old growth will be almost cut in half. At the end of the 16-year transition, only 5 million feet of old growth will be provided for small sales and specialty products. Some of those objecting to the draft plan called for a full inventory of young or second growth trees. Environmental groups argue a completed inventory will show a faster transition is possible, but industry groups argue the exact opposite. Tonga Supervisor Stewart addressed the concern in a press conference, saying 50,000 acres will be inventoried by 2018.
The data collection and everything is being housed and will continue to be assessed as we work through this project, and so it certainly could change. At this point in time, it's only partially finished because 2016 was the first year of actual on-the-ground inventory.
Forest Service tree expert Sheila Spores says a large portion of young growth stands slated for logging were first cut in the 1950s and 1960s. She noted that the agency is aware of how many stands are on the Tongass. She says today's regulatory standards will be applied to inventory available stands. Stewart explained that any young growth acreage made unavailable may be swapped out for additional lands elsewhere.
There's an adaptive management strategy that seeks to recognize the ongoing young growth inventory and seeks to monitor the projected versus the actual harvest over time. They'll be reviewing the effectiveness of that adaptive management process in about 5 or 10 years.
The decision explains that if amounts of timber harvested vary enough from estimations, those issues could be addressed in another amendment. The decision was met with mixed results from environmental groups.
The thing the plan did do that was very good for conserving the resources on the Tongass is identify the key areas that need to be taken off the table for timber harvest.
That's Andrew Tomes, a Tongass Advisory Committee member.
Everybody agreed that the top salmon-producing watersheds on the Tongass shouldn't have any more old-growth harvest.
The committee was made of 15 members from conservation, logging, and native interests. Tomes also works for the Sikkut Conservation Society. He noted that he would like to see old-growth logging end immediately, but says the amendment is the best compromise. Other environmental groups argued in press releases that the decision's language didn't set old-growth harvest volumes in stone. Others say they feel comfortable with the plan being finalized prior to President-elect Donald Trump taking office. The Tongass plan decision does say the Forest Service will monitor market demands and make changes through its adaptive management plan. Tongass Supervisor Stewart also mentioned that a study is being developed to examine ways to make young growth products profitable. The plan will go into effect on January 8th. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Miller, Ed Schoenfeld, and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, and Aaron Bolton in Wrangell. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
GCI. Keeping Alaskans connected to live the life they choose. GCI is an Alaska-born and raised telecommunications company and a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.